live from the shadows. You can't see me at all.
No, you when you turn off that light, I can't see you over the Zoom, and you got a window there, so you're all. I mean, this is for the listener. We're recording at a different time than usual. We're recording in the daylight, in the afternoon. Matt's on vacation. I'm still at home. I'm still in the attic. But Matt, the first 5 minutes before we started recording, it was a lot of Matt looking at himself, not liking the light situation. But
yeah, there's bright lights above my head. It's not important. Right. Okay. We'll move along. I'm recording from my old,
we're talking books.
My childhood bedroom, which is now my father's office. So
has your dad made the your old bedroom a nicer place? Spruced it up.
Oh yeah.
Nice plant behind you.
It's kind of the guest where people can crash on the air mattress here. There's a bookshelf behind me.
Any books in there?
Yeah, a bunch of dad biographies, kids' books, and Bible commentaries, actually.
There you go. Yeah. Well-rounded bookcase.
All right. I'm in a very interesting place right now.
Okay.
Mentally.
Mentally.
Don't you want to know why?
Yeah, I'm curious.
No. It's, so on vacation, just hanging out in Topeka with, you know, my wife and my kid and my brothers and their four children.
That's, yeah.
And so what we did today, we saw the 10 a.m. showing of Indiana Jones in the Dial of Destiny. Right?
Yeah.
And so usually in the morning, I just have coffee. That's my normal. Normally breakfast, I'll just have coffee. And so I did that this morning and, you know, just hung out, nice leisurely morning. First order of business was to go to the movie theater. I'm running on about 5 cups of coffee, which is normal, which is fine. It's normal. I can handle it.
You had five cups before 10 a.m.?
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe like 6:30, and then I just, you know, sip on coffee all morning.
Okay.
So we go to the movie theater. Buy a thing of popcorn and the largest, like a large, very large thing of Diet Coke for $10. Just the Coke costs $10. And I get up there and there's candy waiting for me. There's four children there and they had saved some for me. So my breakfast consisted of Diet Coke, popcorn, and a whole thing of jelly beans as I watched Indiana Jones 5.
Yeah.
So I'm riding and maybe cresting. Just
you might fall asleep during this podcast.
Well,
possible. How long is that? The old Indiana Jones.
It's like 3 hours.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
I'm not sure we're gonna get the best out of you.
No, I'm good. I have drinking coffee now.
Another cup of coffee.
Yeah, it was an interesting breakfast. It was an interesting experience. Felt pretty good.
Do you feel sick?
No.
Have you eaten anything after the movie?
I had a hot dog.
I'm feeling a little queasy hearing all this.
No, it's good. It's an interesting.
By the way, I love going to the movies. I'm jealous of you.
Me too. This is the first time in over 3 years we've gone to a movie. So
isn't that movie bad?
It's okay. I would compare it to what I ate during the movie. A thing of jelly beans. Diet Coke and popcorn.
Did everyone else partake in sort of the movie theater cuisine?
Yeah, I think the kids had breakfast and everything. You know, and did they can hit kids candy better than
the kids understand the importance of 80-year-old Harrison Ford reprising his role as Ben Jones.
Yeah, and they loved the original three, so they were very excited to see it, and they liked it.
I don't know if I've seen all three of the original three.
Yeah, they're good.
Okay. I think I've seen them, probably. There's a boulder in one of them. There's a snake, right? There's snakes?
There's snakes. That's the
same. Let's see here. What's going on in the other? I think he rides in the, like... Sean Connery is in one of them, and he's in the side caboose of a motorcycle.
Yep.
It's pretty much what I took from all of them.
Yeah, right. Spot on memory, yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's right. I mean, is that three different movies? Did I just describe three different movies?
No, you described the two. You briefly described two of them. And there's the whole Temple of Doom one.
There's a temple in one, right?
And it's a Doom temple. And they have the snakes and monkey brains to eat. And,
yeah. Okay. So it was an okay movie.
The consensus is better than that fourth one they did, but not as good as the original.
That one has the alien. I saw the fourth one. It has aliens in it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Is that spoiler alert?
Nah.
Okay.
What's weird about that? Everyone acts like the aliens put it over the top. Like, that's crazy. Mm. But, you know, the other ones had some crazy stuff too. Like the Ark of the Covenant melting people's face off.
Of course.
A guy had his heart ripped out of his chest and still lives. In the third one, there's a 1,000-year-old man who is immortal because of the Holy Grail. Mm. So Crystal Skull was not a good movie, but the aliens weren't out of the blue. That wasn't what ruined the movie. Aliens are in keeping with the whole, like, immortality. That's fine.
Hasn't the take two of Aliens been kind of, it's aged well. Aliens are now, like, everyone seemingly is like, yeah, aliens exist, right?
It's weird. They're kind of like mainstream. Yeah.
It just happened slowly, right?
Which makes me distrust it, actually.
I know.
It's like, are we like, oh, okay. Like, I don't. I believe there are aliens out there somewhere, but I don't like trust your narrative on it.
The government's very casual about it. Feels like a little bit.
Like, oh yeah, we don't know what those are.
It's a subtle brag about their new technology.
I wonder if that's kind of could be. I suspect
that would be my, out of left field theory. It's they're bragging about their new planes.
Yeah.
Our own pilots can't decipher, like the regular pilots. Like, oh, I haven't done it. It's our own planes, but they're cool. Our cool new planes.
I think you're onto that. I think you're onto something. It's like interdepartmental bragging. Yeah.
It's like the sales department and the receiving department are fighting. Mm-hmm.
And they lure their rival department into being, we don't know what these are, they're probably aliens. And then the super secret Pentagon department comes in and is like, oh yeah, it's ours. You thought they were aliens because they're so good. Or it's like something to do with China or like rival countries. I don't know. But I just don't try. Aliens are out there somewhere, but it's just a question of whether. I don't trust the narrative shift all of a sudden.
Yeah, me neither. We're recording this 4th of July week, right? And you're having a good time, seems like, family out there in the Kansas Plains.
Yeah.
Wife was watching, and she did. I want to get your take on this, because I was like, I don't think you're describing this right. Independence Day, right? 4th of July movie.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm jealous that you thought of that, It's a good movie.
Perfect, yeah.
She described it as a cult classic.
I hate to do that to her, but no, cult classic.
She doesn't like it when I'm like, I don't, and I'm on. I will say this, it was like a good, like, oh, I wish I would have thought of watching this, but I didn't. I was like, cult classic, really?
It's a perfect 4th of July movie.
It's a perfect. You know what she did too? She watched the second one.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, they did do a second one. Anyway, here, while we're on it, let me just run it down real quick, because I love disagreeing with you too.
Yeah.
But cult classic needs to be unsuccessful at the box office initially, and then develop a cult following amongst a few dedicated fans that keeps it alive underground, right? So Independence Day, I believe, is very successful at the box office, so it can't quite be a cult classic.
But I'm still jealous of her idea, like, why? Because I came home, I had to work on 4th of July, hardworking guy. It's terrible. And I was like, a little Independence Day, right before the big speech. We will not go quietly into the night. It's the world.
That's at the end, isn't it?
Kind of, yeah.
She didn't even wait on you.
No, see, I can't blame her, though.
A lot
when
of
you
people
got an idea that good, you just got to go for it.
I mean, okay. It's a good idea.
I mean, I don't think I would have sat down there and watched it anyway.
It's a good 4th. Jaws. A lot of people watch Jaws on the 4th of July.
Yeah, the Jaws. What other... Is there a book you would read on 4th of July?
Not specifically. I think there are good, like, movies. I think Die Hard with a Vengeance is a summer movie. I don't know if it's a 4th of July movie, but that's a good
That would be a good 4th of July.
What about summer?
What about The Patriot?
I guess so. Yeah, Mel Gibson. It's all right. It was like Braveheart in the 1700s.
I kind of liked it when I saw it in theaters. I don't know if I would like
it. It's a bummer.
It is a bummer.
Yeah, it'll be a fun. Yeah, it's an entertaining movie.
Any other thoughts on the getting any reading done this week, man?
No. I finished the David Foster Wallace essay.
And which we're talking about on this week's episode.
Yeah.
And I surprised you, too. Let's get into it. Let me do the intro and we'll get into David Foster Wallace. I kind of forgot how to do the intro because you didn't lead me into the intro, man. Welcome to There Will Be Books, a podcast about books and the 4th of July. I'm Peter, joined as always by Matt. See, when I don't have a natural intro, I'm not a natural host, right? So I'm not Jimmy Fallon here. Should I leave that in? I'll leave that in.
Nah, take that out.
Take that out?
Take it out. There's a natural. It's a,
I'm writing down edit.
Make edits. And then you don't need to make the edits. It's fine.
Last week, you prepped for the David Foster Wallace.
Mm-hmm.
And you said it was like 100 pages. I had found what turns out to be a edited version of 25 pages. Now, I rectified that. All right. I went on the library has the, I've just started getting into this, like the ebooks that you can check out from the library. Checked out the David Foster Wallace essay that was included in this, and I read it in one day, Matt. 100 pages.
So the full footnotes and all?
Okay. That is my next point of, you might get mad at me, okay? Promise, I want you to hold up your hand. Promise you won't get super mad at me.
No, if you're going to tell me you didn't read the footnotes, I am going to get mad.
Guess what? I like to read David Foster Wallace without the footnotes.
They're different than Host. You got to read the footnotes.
No.
I don't know how.
No, stop.
No, you can't. Stop. You can't.
Before we get into it, I really enjoyed this essay. It's 100 pages. Why do I have to read some? I clicked on a couple of them. They're very easy on an e-reader too, by the way. The footnotes. They're not
I was gonna ask you.
I can just ignore them. My brain doesn't go, oh, I gotta go down here and read this and read that. I clicked on a couple and I was like, oh, I remember these. These are annoying. So
I ruined it by having you read Host first.
That was a huge issue by you.
You get an incomplete on this assignment.
No, I don't.
Yeah, no, you do.
If you read a history book and you don't read the footnotes, you still read the history book.
Not for this. Not
no, that's, oh man, this is a big point in contention. If you're listening to this, you have to get in contact with us. Send us
especially on this one, because they're not a chore. They're not the extra boring stuff. They're part of
Let me find one, okay? The essay we're talking about is A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again, which is the title of the essay collection, but it is the title of the essay about David Foster Wallace taking a kind of like a mega cruise liner type thing in the 90s. I didn't read any of the footnotes.
Okay.
And I would give this essay 5 stars. So how does that make you feel? If I read the footnotes, I think I would have given it probably 3 stars.
No, you wouldn't have.
No, come on.
Nah. You get an incomplete. It's 5 stars as well. It's one of the best.
I read the third footnote. Not added nothing.
No, you have to read the footnotes with David Foster Wallace. Sorry.
I do?
Yeah.
I don't think I do.
You do.
I'm not going to.
Yeah.
From now on, I'm going to read David Foster Wallace on an e-reader. So I don't see the footnotes sort of like at the bottom of the page. Because here's the thing. If people haven't read David Foster Wallace, some of the footnotes take up a whole page, right? Mm-hmm. I don't want to do that.
You do nothing but read all the time.
So where do we go from here?
We'll keep going. You like essay. Well, we won't let this.
Well, you're saying I didn't finish it.
Mm-hmm.
Man.
If you continue to not read footnotes, you're going to get all incompletes and you're not going to graduate.
No, see, I'm graduating. My dad's going to send a letter to the principal saying the footnotes aren't necessary. My son enjoyed the essay to a complete degree. He didn't feel lost. He didn't feel like he wasn't getting the full picture. And I think I'm going to graduate. I'm going to walk, Matt. You watch me. I'm walking. And you're going to be the mopey English teacher. He said, that kid shouldn't be graduating. He didn't read the footnotes.
All right, Ferris Bueller.
And I'm going to, I don't know, snub my nose at you, okay? And you're just going to...
Okay, just we'll get off. We won't let this derail the whole thing. We'll get off it.
No,
just
know it's not. No,
you didn't complete
the assignment. Fine. It's not. It's totally fine.
You didn't complete the assignment.
Okay, you're really disappointed.
Yeah, it's my fault.
What am I missing with the footnotes?
To complete the whole context.
You get the gist. Yeah, but why doesn't he put the stuff in the footnotes into the essay?
It's part of the narrative strategy.
Okay.
Right?
Does everything he does have footnotes?
For the most part.
Okay.
Maybe Broom of the System didn't. I don't remember.
I was going to be very negative about... I was going to be very negative. I was going to be very negative about the footnote aspect and very positive about the essay aspect. I might just lie to you and say I didn't like this essay.
It's a very good essay, isn't it? We'll move on. Like it's
let me talk about what I liked about the thing.
Yeah, yeah.
His writing style. Very funny. I like his observations.
Hilarious.
It's an essay. It's my kind of like my favorite kind of essay. You know, a writer goes on a something he wouldn't normally do, but it's something that most people are familiar with or are huge fans of, right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of, and he's not totally disengaged from the whole activity of the cruise ship, right? He's not making fun of everybody, or he's not making fun of the concept of it. That's very easy to do. That's also very lazy, in my opinion.
He's not like a sourpuss about it.
Yeah, he's not draped in irony or I don't know contempt for the subject matter or whatever. So I enjoyed that aspect. Very funny. Kind of makes you think about maybe not cruise ships, but how things are sold to large groups of people, like the masses. Uh-huh. Something I was thinking about, sort of the you'll have no worries, you'll have no cares. And that seemingly is the case, but then your brain also like starts to create things that you're annoyed with or...
What does it mean to be 100% pampered?
Pamperedness.
By a corporation that wants to sell you something. And it's just, what does that do?
I love the aspect of sort of the nature of, the guest is pampered 100%. And then the aspect of the people who work on the ship having to do that. And there's like when he wants he carries his bag in and that creates an uproar for the person who's like, no, I need to, you cannot do this.
Yeah, you're going
to... That dynamic of worker trying to,
he's putting the worker's job in jeopardy.
Yes.
But he thinks he's being nice and be like, no, I'm going to carry my own bag.
He's like, no, I don't understand. This is my job, is to carry your bag.
He's like, if my boss... He doesn't say this, but it's like, if my boss sees you carrying your own bag, I'm going to get in trouble. And so,
So
what do you mean on a cruise like that to be a low-level employee who cleans the bathrooms or the porter or whatever? Going in with a pampering aspect is good. I'm glad you liked it.
No, I really liked this essay. I didn't read the footnotes. my first part of the book that I highlighted, which is highlights his humor. He goes, I have heard upscale adult U.S. citizens ask the guest relations desk whether snorkeling necessitates getting wet, whether the skeet shooting will be held outside, whether the crew sleeps on board, and what time the midnight buffet is. Very funny. Very funny. Very sharp humor there by Mr. David Foster Wallace. Question. When did you first read this essay? Recently, or was this when you first started getting into David Foster Wallace?
When I first started getting into him, maybe 15, 20 years ago.
Okay. That's interesting. Yeah. What also struck me is the idea of cruise ships, I feel, has changed. It was something that I kind of was thinking about while I was reading this. Cruise ships were once this very trendy and sort of people might still do this, take cruise ships like maybe once a year. Like they would continually, and he kind of talks about this. There is a group of people that like know the ins and outs of cruise ship life, and they exploit it and they get the most benefit from it. And then there's kind of people from David Foster Wallace who he enjoys aspects of it, but he doesn't like, you know, tight spaces and confined spaces with people. And obviously cruise ships took a hit during COVID, but I think before that they had taken a hit as far as you would hear about large groups of people getting sick on cruise ships often. Like that was the publicity of cruise ships is
like nightmare stories. Everybody gets a virus.
The plumbing goes out or something crazy like that. Or it just hasn't had the greatest PR.
But I think people still do them.
I do. Yeah, I agree.
And I actually saw there's some big PR push. There's the world's biggest cruise ship to date was just launched.
Oh, really?
Like some 1.5, 2 times bigger than your average cruise. So they're still going. People still do Alaska cruises. I was just talking to somebody who's.
I was just at a 4th of July party. Yeah. They just came back from a 4th of July. But a cruise ship in Alaska.
Yeah. So publicity aside, I think it is something with people with an extra little bit of cash go do stuff.
Have you ever been on a cruise?
No.
I personally have been on one.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Was that how did it compare to the essay?
I felt a lot of the things. Well, I was a kid, so I was like a teenager. Okay. So I never had the the interesting insights that he had while I was on it. What I do remember, it's a very extrovert type thing. I feel like the people who enjoy cruise ships are very, me personally, it was just too much. I didn't want to really interact with people. I think a lot of people go there and they make friends with other, people. I don't find that appealing.
Yeah.
On a cruise ship.
I mean, that's you now. I can only imagine.
Yeah, that's me now. And, the seeds of that were evident when I was a teenager. It's just, I don't want to just make random friends with teenagers on aboard I can't remember the cruise ship, but it was like in the Bahamas. So, some of the things he kind of points out, I was like, oh, yeah, that is interesting. Anyway, what were some of the things that you liked about the essay other than the fantastic footnotes?
So in revisiting it, I was struck by it is, I don't know, I'm, this isn't hyperbole. It's up there with Twain as far as humorous travel essays. It's so good. It's so funny. I don't know if I don't know if his reputation as kind of a broody author of weird postmodern or post-postmodern, whatever you categorize his fiction as. I don't know. I don't know if his essays get enough credit. This is a great, funny essay. Top five essay of all time.
Top five essay of all time.
Yeah.
Right. That down.
I mean, it's a classic American essay. It's funny as Twain.
I don't know if I'd go that far. I don't know what I would put in its place. It is a very funny essay. It's very, it has, smart observations, but it is at its core a funny, it's not a takedown. I don't think it's a takedown of the cruise industry, but sort of somewhat a bit of a fish out of water in the setting of the cruise ship life.
Yeah.
But yeah. So
and so he had written kind of a popular, actually it's worth reading. It's in the same collection, the same book. He had gone to the Iowa State Fair and kind of did the same thing. And that was successful enough for Harper's Magazine. Harper's paid him in 1995. It's like, okay, we're going to pay for your trip, go on a cruise and just do what you did with the county fair article. And so that's kind of the backstory. The article you found online, I'm pretty sure was what ran in Harper. And so the cool thing about the book, it's expanded from 25 to 100 pages, all the footnotes and everything. So all his, it's still tight essay form, but it's the expanded edition. And that's what, audience, if you're interested, you should read the one from the book.
It's the last essay in the book collection. There are other, like, there's scenes there where I like when they, like, dock at the, seemingly a bunch of cruise ships just dock at this, at the same sort of, like, port, I guess.
And he's when they stop.
Another cruise ship, and he gets, like, jealous of the other cruise ship because it looks like it's better than the cruise ship he's on. I just thought that was a funny thing. Like, and there's people that he gets drawn to, like, some guy who's, like, video, like, cameras always on, always recording stuff. It is funny. It's a time capsule of the 90s because if there's a very important element of the 90s where everyone like is seemingly lugging around these like huge handheld cameras, which nowadays seem like, oh, that's crazy because you just have your phone and you can just record anything you want at, like quickly. But there was a time where like dad's role was to just carry around this big camera and just record to tape these things that you would probably never ever watch again.
I remember those. You'd have to watch them on a VHS tape. You have to transfer them over. But the big old boombox looking.
There was the big ones. You could get like a little handheld one at the time. I remember those. But you would see all these, you know, if you went to Disney World or anything like that, or you would see a lot of these out and about. So this, I think this is what, the mid-90s, 95, I believe.
95, yeah.
And that was the kind of the peak of the handheld video camera. So if you're a little bit younger, read this essay to learn about what the 90s were like. It's a fun time. Fun time. Going through this map, I really, the one of the funniest things was when he's trying to figure out when they clean his room. Like,
if
you leave for a short, brief time, they don't clean it. But if it's after 30 minutes, they clean his room. And he can't, like, ever find, like, catch the person cleaning his room.
Mm-hmm.
I think that might be a bit of an exaggeration, but I appreciated the license, the creative license to, like, detail. Like, he probably noticed it and then was realizing, I never see this person.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm gone for a short amount of time, but if I'm gone for just a bit longer, they clean my room. How do they know
that? And it was 30 minutes and he writes about going, leaving for 29 minutes and coming in and she's not there and the room's messy, but 31 minutes, you come back and it's clean. And it's kind of I wanted to kind of get into that, the humorous folksy exaggeration, the twang comparison too. Like I've heard people call them kind of like tall tales or whatever. And it's like, he's not imagining it wholesale, but I think you're allowed a certain license if you're doing this sort of Innocence Abroad folksy humor. Like when he plays a 7-year-old girl in chess and loses. And he wrings a lot of humor out of the chess match itself and the mom looking over her shoulder and he really dislikes the mom and whatever. And then Jurassic Park is one of the 5 movies they have playing in your room. And he talks about going back to his room and watching Jurassic Park. And it's the scene where the little kids are being chased by the dinosaur. And he's got a line about how the prospect of a little kid getting eaten by a dinosaur is suddenly less scary to me now, or less distasteful to me now. It's fine if it literally didn't happen like that. You know what I mean? He probably watched Jurassic Park 5 times on that cruise ship and then reworked the terminology just to, it doesn't matter that he didn't literally, likely didn't literally go back and watch Jurassic Park. It was just in his head, I could make this joke and kind of, you know what I mean? And I think you're allowed that license in this type of thing.
I think it's, reminds me of like a comedian taking license with a true story to make it funny.
Yeah.
I think he does.
I was on a plane last week. It doesn't matter if it was literally
last week or whatever. That's funny you mentioned that because I did it. When you said that out loud, I was like, oh, yeah, I can definitely see that in this essay where there's like creative license to spruce up. Like a good storyteller kind of adds a little flavor to it. You know, it's a spice to like not make it a bland. This is exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you get the gist of it. It's almost like a based on a true story type thing. I feel like with some of the storytelling here.
But I would argue it's still true in nature.
Yes.
Does that make sense? But I think you're allowed those little bits of...
In the spirit of, like, the story and what's true, I'd agree. Mm-hmm. It's probably true, but he probably alters it a little bit to make it funnier.
Was he really convinced that Mr. Dermatitis was going to use the cruise ship's plumbing system to murder him? Or was that a thought that crossed his mind? And is like, it'd be funny if I played this up a little bit and made it. And just like with a storyteller's flair, you kind of like, and for a while there, I was worried he was going to flush me down into, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
it's, you play, did he really hate Mona from his dinner table that much? Or was it just kind of funny, you know, to play
up? Or is he that neurotic? They kind of actually, because I get the sense he's kind of an awkward guy.
If you've watched interviews, I think he was in his head a lot and overthought stuff, but he was capable of channeling it into brilliant fiction and entertaining nonfiction. But if you watch him, there's a famous Charlie. He did Charlie Rose back in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting. I'll make you watch it one of these times. But I'm curious how you think he came across. It comes across not quite what you'd expect, not as nerdy, but
obviously
a guy who overthinks things a lot, but is still capable of being compelling as a speaker.
Overthinking is probably where I would come down. It's like that's what he seems like his tendencies to do.
Maybe he was able to harness that into his
that's
work.
Probably where the footnotes come into, like overthinking something where
it's a stray thought on a stray thought on it.
So overthinker, I think, is a good way of putting his, I don't even know if you want to say that as like a describe as like writing style. Because I do appreciate sort of the in-depth nature of his kind of writing and storytelling to a point. I kind of agree with you where you had me read The Host as one of the first two essays. Probably wasn't your smartest idea for making me get to like David Foster Wallace, because that one just kind of drove me insane with the footnotes.
The footnotes.
Inside the text.
Those footnotes are bizarre, and I'm pretty sure I read it. I read these in order, so I was used to them by the, you know, but those were bizarrely formatted, so I should have reversed it. While we're here, I wanted to tell you, so here's some footnotes, some funny little things.
Give me some footnote highlights.
You missed. Okay. Well, yeah. Sometimes they're jokes. Sometimes they're random cruise ship trivia. Sometimes they're jokes. So you get, you know, there's the Mr. Dermatitis, the guy who dislikes him, is mistrustful of him, thinks he's, you know, and won't let him get special access to the things because he thinks he's like a investigative journalist instead of, you know what I mean? So here's the first footnote about at the very beginning, and it kind of, his name is like some Greek sounding Mr. Dimitriopoulos or something, but he calls him Mr. Dermatitis because he hates him, right? It is funny, like he plays it. So here we go. This is talking about Mr. Dermatitis. Somewhere he'd gotten the impression I was an investigative journalist and wouldn't let me see the galley, bridge, staff decks, anything, or interview any of the crew or staff in an on-the-record way. And he wore sunglasses inside and epaulets and kept talking on the phone for long stretches of time in Greek when I was in his office after I'd skipped the karaoke semifinals in the rendezvous lounge to make a special appointment to see him. I wish him ill. That's a footnote, and I think that would have been worth reading.
Yeah. Right? Okay.
You know, maybe. I mean, that sets the stage for, And then there's one more. Do you remember, did you get, because a lot of the stuff, his dinner, you have dinner at the same table every week, right? And Mona, he made a big thing in not liking this kind of spoiled teenage girl named Mona, whose grandparents take her on a cruise every year. Did you get that, or is that all footnotes?
That might be footnotes.
Okay. You don't remember Mona? It's a whole, yeah. So I'm looking at, it's like a page and a half.
Footnotes. I remember, because I remember this from my own experience, the table thing is slightly odd. Like, it can either be the best thing on your trip or sort of a bummer, because if you don't like the people you're sitting with, you might just...
Yep.
You know, maybe skip a meal or two a day.
Yep. So hey, so you got you missed. I'm just realizing footnote 32. You missed all this context, the inside dope
didn't.
about
I don't feel like
his
I did. I don't care about
about
Mona.
Mona. No, I'm telling you, it's a page two and a half page footnotes, kind of where he gets everything out of the way about his dying
What
companions.
footnote number is that? Does it have? Because in the
32.
32. All right.
32. With the conspicuous exception of Mona, I liked all my table hits a lot, which is kind of funny. And he says, I'm going to get out of this description out of the way in a footnote. So anyway, Mona is 18. Her grandparents have been taking her on a luxury cruise every spring since she was five. Blah, blah, blah. So anyway, it's kind of he hates this teenage girl at his table. But in how much does he really hate her and how much is he just, playing it up? She pretends it's her birthday to get a free meal, free birthday cake, even though she's basically an adult. Her real birthday, she informs me, is on Monday. It's July 29th. And when I observe that July 29th is also the birthday of Benito Mussolini, Mona's grandmother shoots me a kind of death look. Although Mona herself is excited at the coincidence, apparently confusing the names Mussolini and Maserati. Just as.
I don't even know. I'm going through this section right here on the Eve copy. I don't even know if I get the full footnotes, if I'm being
Okay.
completely honest with you.
Which fine, I'll let it go. I'm not even trying to convince you anymore. I just want the listener to realize if you're reading the book, the footnotes are worthwhile and you get funny little jokes.
Do you want to get in
Anyway.
depth about like the nature of pampering and the people that have to do
Yeah.
the pampering and the, because there is he kind of gets into it and you kind of are left with left me thinking, like in this day and age, how do you, I don't know, where do you want to go with this? Because I think it is an interesting concept of the cruise. It doesn't even have to be a cruise or an all-exclusive vacation. There's this sense of pampering, and then you, as someone who does this, maybe you're not comfortable with the 100%, like, I'm just giving myself up. I have no worries. I have nothing. I'm not going to do anything. And you fall into this trap of wanting everything all the time and then becoming disappointed when it doesn't, like, when expectations aren't met to the extent that the cruise says they are, but it's
Or they
still
have
very,
been.
or have been, but it's still
But what
very
does that do
surface, right?
to,
Yeah.
or to
What do
the
you,
human, the very human grass is always greener kind of syndrome, right? Where you pan, like he talks about how they really did. They were on top of everything. They cleaned his room every time he left for 30 minutes, all that stuff. But when you get used to that level of thing and get used to it very quickly within a matter of days, you start to notice everything and expect even more. It's like, why didn't they, it's ridiculous for them to send you fresh fruit to your room, like every time they clean it. But then, you look at the fresh fruit and you're like, oh, there's too many bananas and not enough pineapple or whatever it is, right? You start to get really petty. And his, he notices stuff like that and kind of notices those little conundrums of modern life and the things that are sold to you versus in reality and what that does to you. He's got a famous line somewhere else where he's talking about how the food and care and a lot of this stuff is being delivered by corporations. And he was wondering about what that does to human beings when the necessities of life are given to you by people or institutions that do not love you. He said, right? Yeah. Well, that's what makes him relevant today is those type of observations that have only, like, because this phenomenon, the pampering thing, that thing with the corporations or distant people providing you your necessities, where once it was family or your mother or whatever, that hasn't got, that's been exacerbated over the last 30 years. It hasn't gone away.
Well, it's also something, it's not just pampering, it's like ease of lifestyle. It's ease of life. It's taking away the annoyance of maybe day-to-day life that I think is sort of getting parts of this essay are getting into, like going back to that after being pampered. But it's almost, it feels like, and maybe it's not completely right, but like in society today, we're being sold different things to take away the annoyance of life or the annoyance of, I mean, you. I hear these things where it's like sign up for this program and we'll cancel your unwanted subscriptions. And I'm like,
yeah,
that might be handy, but isn't that just another layer of like,
we'll take care of your life for
yeah,
it.
Yeah. It's just a very, like, there's other examples of that, but it's just maybe just, you know, you do that yourself and that's it. But
well, what is the duty? Can you outsource your responsibilities as a human being?
Yeah.
Or is that just part of it, right? You signed up for the subscriptions, and if you want to be done with it, maybe you got to call 10 different magazines and can't, you know, like that. That's an interesting question. Is it part of it? Or is 51 weeks of drudgery and kind of ennui in life, can a week out in the Bahamas where you don't have to worry about anything, maybe that's part of the appeal of the cruises. If you're middle class and have disposable income, I mean, $5,000 to $10,000, you can look forward to that 1 week a year where you pretty much don't have to do anything.
But I don't know. It's a very interesting idea because I was thinking about this because it's how do you know you're satisfied with this? Because you have some expectation. And then if it's disappointing, do you just lie to yourself or do you, or if they're doing their job well, and then do you carry this on and want to be pampered the rest of your life? Or people that go on these things who are pampered, or, you know what I mean? Like, there's this thing where it can change you for not, you know, maybe it's not good to be pampered to this extent. It makes you a bad person. Is there any truth to that? If you're pampered to this extent,
I think it makes you a bad person.
No, I'm not saying, but I'm not saying like a cruise ship setting. I'm just saying in general life, like the very wealthy or the well-to-do or the brought up in this and you're pampered and you get all these benefits. Isn't there like a danger to that?
Yeah. And I think that's what he's getting.
Yeah. Cause I feel like that's what he's sort of hinting at. Of,
I think he's getting
no worries lifestyle is actually doesn't do you a service.
Yeah. You can't outsource all your responsibilities to other people, and it's there's also the kind of unstated thing: these people might not mean you well, want what's best for you, right? They're selling you something,
yeah,
to make money,
and it,
I
also find it interesting the people that have to, let's say, who work for the cruise ship, for the example of the essay, they just are doing their job and they don't want to get fired. But there is no, the amount of care and service they're giving you isn't reflective of they like you as the person, like as the customer. It's just, I need to do this for my job. And it's interesting when he kind of screws that up, like we talked about before, they get like, no, don't carry your bag. Or don't do this, or don't do something that would be a normal thing that you would automatically do in your day-to-day life. It's like, no. The whole premise of this thing is set up where I do everything.
Yep. You think you're being nice, but you're getting
don't be nice. Don't be nice.
Yeah.
Is that the thing to take away from this? Is don't be nice?
No. Well, it's sitting with the, you know. It is a bit, with the ambiguity of the whole situation. And a lot of it is also kind of managed fun. I don't know if you ever went to summer camp, but in the summer camp I went to as a kid, it was generally pretty fun, but from like 1 to 3 every afternoon, there was activities. It was either arts and craft or archery and that was my least favorite, like the sort of managed activities I hated. The spoon race or the blindfold, you got to hop on one leg blindfolded. That's like my least favorite activity. Those are my least favorite things to do. And so the cruise ship is kind of one big managed fun camp counselor. Like, okay, everybody, we're going to make macrame and do all these things. And I think there's a certain personality that kind of bristles at that. So
what is
a supposedly fun thing, right?
Do you think there are cruise ships where they just don't have activities and you're just on a boat? And like they do,
young
singles, I don't know if they have that, but
I mean, I think you can opt out. I mean, honestly, and frankly, I was going to get to this at the end, but do you think, I think I'd have fun. I think I'd go if an opportunity were presented me. If
I like the buffets, and I think they have buffets on cruises. So I think I would, that would be like my highlight.
I'd go hang out, watch a lot of movies in my room.
Yeah. There's good people watching. The one aspect that is rough is when it is like rough seas, it's completely like there's nothing fun about it unless you just don't get seasick. It's not fun.
I don't think I do, but I don't know if you ever really find out till you're out there.
Yeah, because it's an odd experience. I remember that being like, whoa, because you're looking at something, you're like, why is that moving? And you're like, oh, wait, I'm moving. And it's like, oh, no.
There's a footnote about that.
Oh, see, I didn't.
There's a footnote about how weird it is to walk on a cruise ship.
Well, in the essay, he talks about pitch and roll. I got that part of it, right? Rolling is side to side, pitch is up and down. You can do pitch without getting seasick. Rolling is a little bit hard because you're not used to like stepping to your side to prevent yourself from tipping over. I got that part. I don't think I missed that much from the footnotes.
Okay.
Now I'm starting to feel slightly bad that I didn't read the footnotes.
Just incomplete. You can finish it at any time.
It's not incomplete.
You get an incomplete. There's also, while we're kind of on the subject, the I like the part with the hypnotist at the end. This wasn't in a footnote. This is in the there's something crucially key about luxury cruises and evidence here, being entertained by someone who clearly dislikes you and feeling that you deserve the dislike at the same time that you resent it.
Mm.
That was kind of key too. He talks about how the ship's hypnotist kind of had a disdain for the audience, and he probably maybe didn't want to have a career as a cruise ship. Like cruise ship entertainers, kind of
sad.
That's not the peak. You want to be on TV in the movies or something. You don't necessarily want to be a cruise ship. So it was interesting. He probably a little bitter about it and took it out on the audience, but the audience ate it up. Like a little Don Rickles energy. They love it. So it was similar to what we were talking about earlier.
It almost feels like the entertainment on cruise ships is like somewhat depressing if you take a step back from it. Because the entertainers, this can't be their like thing that they would, grew up wanting to do.
Hey, I mean, maybe it's factory work. I don't know. I don't want to look down on it too much, right? The salient point was, I think, it's not just cruise ships, but being entertained by people who disdain you, or your demographic or whatever, but kind of eating it up, but also kind of resent being like, hey.
I see it as not even the disdain you, but the soul has left them. Like this is, it's crushing. They're in a cycle of, they just go on a cruise week after week after week. And they're really
the entertainers. Yeah.
And it's just like, they have a blank look on their faces. And it's just like, I love doing this. Maybe they don't disdain you, but they have the shine has worn off the job. Like the job is sold to you as, travel around the world on a cruise ship and you have friends and you'll do all this stuff and you'll see, I don't know how much free time they actually have. I think that's something that maybe was put in a footnote. But I would imagine that the shine of the job would wear off fairly quickly.
Yeah.
But who knows? Maybe there are some lifelong people who work on cruise ships, but. Seems like an interesting life. 5 stars for the ESA, 0 stars for the footnotes.
Hey, there's some good. I just thought it's like three other things from the footnotes.
Way better than the host, I'll say that. Way
better. Yeah. I like the content of the host. I think the footnotes were.
The footnotes. Man, I'm going to say it right now, Matt. The footnotes ruined that essay.
Okay.
And I don't know how you can't convince me otherwise.
Okay. Well, no, I'll give up. It's a losing battle. It's going to be rough to tackle Infinite Jest eventually. Yeah. It's all right. We won't do it unless the public.
Year 20 of the podcast, you do that?
Oh, let's see. There was a whole Frank Conroy aspect I kind of found interesting.
Hey, kind of breaking down, but kind of deservedly, I thought.
I thought it was an interesting thing for him to worry about, and it without taking sides or looking down on Frank Conroy as a writer. The popular author Frank Conroy had written what looks like an essay for the cruise company, but it turns out it's an ad, but it's a well-written essay about how pleasant the cruise ship experience is. And Wallace takes issue with how it seems like an essay. And he goes into kind of the distinction between art, or, you know, an honest essay, you owe your audience the unfiltered truth, and an ad is different than that. And so to try to trick somebody by making them think you're reading art and you're really reading an ad, he thought was a disservice to the reader. And I thought that was important to understanding his psychology, and I thought it was actually a pretty good point.
It's also coming from a time, 1995, I don't feel like this is a very common thing. Like, this is a common practice now. Like, you're reading this now, it's like, oh, this happens all the time.
And first thing I thought of was George Saunders writing his little short stories on the Chipotle bags. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
So
it's very, reading this now, but you have to think, you know, 1995, this, you know, newspapers are still very popular. Like, the idea that, it's just interesting to see it, how sort of, I don't know, journalism, or not even journalism, but sort of putting ads in, like hiding ads, I guess is kind of what the game is nowadays. How it's like, that's the norm. Like, people get upset about it, but it's just like a losing battle at this point.
It just happened.
But, you know, 30 years ago, this is like, hey, I mean, and rightfully so, like, that's kind of shady. You know, writing a kind of a PR puff piece, and it's kind of like, oh, it's just a positive thing about the cruise line industry. I thought that was an interesting point, but what struck me about that section is how far that has, like, infiltrated our lives. It's like, it makes people distrustful, right? Because what's an ad? What's not an ad? They're supposed to say what's an ad, but it's...
It's hard to tell sometimes.
Yeah.
Product placement and But I thought that was, you missed another footnote where he asked the PR lady for the cruise ship, and he gets a whole paragraph of PR fluff and prints it all in full. And then I contacted Mr. Conroy, who, after a long, heavy sigh, said, I prostituted myself. Like, he's trying not to be too hard on Frank Conroy, who is interesting. He says Frank Conroy is one of the people who made him think he could be a writer. So it's an interesting dichotomy between seeing one of your inspirations kind of sell out on this cruise ship. Wow. It's also kind of, he is consciously trying not to do that with the cruise industry. You know what I mean? Not that he would, but he's also kind of, okay, I have to produce and be honest with the reader here, and I can't just do a puff piece for the cruise ship.
Counter to that, though, writers for a long time would write for money, right? This notion that the writer had to be like this noble thing. I think it's kind of, it's gone in like cycles, right? Like, there are famous writers, if you read about them, they're like, oh yeah, they just wrote this for just to get money, or they wrote this and it's not their serious work, or maybe become popular. But this idea that writers shouldn't write for money.
There's a difference between writing an entertaining novel
and
writing an ad copy.
Yeah. Right. I got that, but
and you're right. It does happen. I wouldn't even necessarily fault a writer for doing it. You got to pay the bills, right? Mm-hmm. But it's interesting to see where he's coming from, and I think that's something noble to aspire to—just pure, unfiltered truth between you and the reader. It may not always happen, right? But it is a good guiding star, lodestar. Yeah. What's the term? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Having that as your compass, your goal.
I'm going to give you the talent of David Foster Wallace, right? I've given that to you.
I'll take it.
Okay. Yeah. I'm giving that to you.
Okay.
And I want you, and I kind of open-ended question. I'm assigning you to write this sort of piece on a field of industry, an event. What would you choose?
Okay.
Okay. So he did the Iowa Fair. He did the lobster thing on cruise ship. I'm sure you've done other ones like this, but where would you, I've given you the talent, but you have your sort of interest still. Where would you write it? What would you write about? And where would you go?
First thing spring to mind.
Yeah.
It dovetails with our Paper Lion that we did a couple years ago.
Yeah.
I want to go behind the scenes with a baseball team.
That's very interesting, because the one I came up with is spring training.
Yep.
Okay.
Something like that.
And the reason for that is, it's just, the people who go to watch spring training are kind of an interesting breed of like fan. The baseball players themselves, most of them aren't on the actual team, right? Won't make the actual team. And then there's sort of the veteran who is maybe doesn't like it. And there's all these weird elements. It's in sort of retirement areas in Arizona and Florida. That's what I kind of came to. It's like a very odd thing, right?
That's perfect. Yeah, that'd be great. And you could have a lot of fun with that. And all mine will bookend that. I just thought I would use whatever magazine I'm writing for as pull, and I would, when the playoffs roll around, right? I would have my pick of one of the whatever playoff teams. I'd follow the Texas Rangers or whatever for a week, their first playoff series. And I would have access to, and I would, the dynamic of playoff baseball. I think I would do something like that. I think you could.
Another one I just thought of, film festival.
Ooh, like Sundance?
No, maybe not like, go, yeah, a big one where like there's some like smaller ones. There's some in Colorado, like Telluride. And I would angle it as, you know, writing about the you know, aspiring filmmakers, but also the locals who have to deal with providing for the film festival, right? I think that, I don't know. It's kind of an interesting thought experiment of.
It is.
I don't know.
I'm sure I'll think of five more, but that'd be fun to do. Do you think, I wonder if we could do this with the podcast somehow. I tried to get us tickets to the All-Star game when it was in Denver. And they told me, they didn't say, no, that's silly, you're a stupid podcast. They said, oh, you missed the deadline to apply.
Oh.
So I'll see if we can get tickets to a Broncos game this year.
And then put on our David Foster Wallace caps, put on our bandanas.
Figuratively, not literally, figuratively.
Figuratively.
And we just ask.
Hey.
I don't know, ask what they read and just get blank stares.
Like, you guys ever just scuff up the baseballs? Do some of that? Hey, try to get them to. You know, hey, we won't say the names. Just tell us how you cheat. Tell us how you cheat.
Yeah. What would?
Yeah. I don't know. Anyway, any other thoughts, Matt, on this essay?
Yeah. I got some random ephemera.
Give me some quotes. Then, give me some things you like. Give me some footnotes you love to make me feel bad. But
some random stuff. We cover the footnotes. Let me do some random stuff. Then I'll go get our guests.
We have a special guest this week.
All right. So, hey, you know what I thought would be a good little fun novel, entertainment? Mm-hmm. Murder mystery set on a cruise ship.
Okay. That's,
thinking that?
That's a good idea. He's
describing how big it is. It's a cast. It'll be like a locked room mystery. The killer's got to be one of these people. It'd be fun. I think you'd have a lot of fun with it. The one big narrative obstacle, I think, would be, when this murder happens, how do you get the crews to keep going, right? Mm-hmm. And the police would come aboard and they dock everybody and interview. So how do you keep, because I'd want the crews to keep going despite the murder. So that'd be your obstacle. But I think a murder mystery on a cruise ship, maybe it'd have to be a disappearance, right?
Problem is,
somebody disappears.
That actually happens, though, on cruise ships.
And the companies kind of bury it. And
it's kind of a problem.
But I'm saying, but no, okay, so you just
cruise ships and disappear.
Oh, it's totally doable. I'm sure it's done it. If you're aware of a murder mystery like this, I'm interested. But you know, exactly. That's how you overcome that obstacle. It's like, okay, what happens in real life? Does the cruise ship cover it up? Does that mean the captain murdered somebody? Who knows? Our protagonist, are they going crazy? Or I'm pretty sure the guy I saw on the first day is gone now. What happened to him?
No,
right?
I just came up with the worst idea, but for me, it's funnier.
Well, let's hear it.
It's going to be an elaborate prank on a cruise ship, okay?
Yeah.
You and your family get on a cruise ship. You're told, all right, here are the floors you can go on. Don't go below floor 5. We're actually transporting a bunch of prisoners, okay?
Cruise ship?
The cruise ship is, all right? Follow me. You're like, oh, that's odd that they're transporting prisoners. 3 days into the cruise, there becomes an alarm or warning sound. Like, I think the cruises can, like, there's intercom system. They go, not to worry you folks. One of the doors was bent open on level 3, and we're looking for a few individuals. And then you and your family are like, oh, no, the prisoners have gotten out. But it's all an elaborate prank. It's all a prank.
Mm.
Pretty good idea.
It's a decent once you get past the obstacle of why they're transporting prisoners on a cruise ship. Yeah, the PA. We're looking for a passenger with 17 locusts tattooed on his face. If you notice, he has a
And
serial
then
number.
it's all just chaos after that. And then a storm hits, and then,
No.
oh man.
No, what it is, they're not transporting a whole ton of prisoners. There's the notorious Hannibal Lecter style serial
Oh,
killer
that's come on.
who escaped from prison a year or so ago. And then our protagonist, who's a true crime junkie, swears she sees, I saw the serial killer. He's on this ship. And nobody believes her because it's, you know what I mean? But she's like convinced that Hannibal Lecter, that type of
About
suave,
this.
sophisticated killer, is on the ship, and nobody believes her. But she determines to go find out if she's on a cruise ship with a serial killer.
How about
That's good.
this? Okay,
That's good right there.
I'm gonna tweak your idea a little bit.
Okay.
The serial killer escapes, and they think he's been hiding out on one of these remote islands that you can kind of visit for like a day trip. You meet up with the serial killer, like befriends a family. Says, "Oh yeah, I'm on that ship." Gets back on one of these like little boats, comes back to the cruise ship.
What?
Yeah,
That's
now he's
not
on the ship. He wasn't gonna be on the ship. Now he's on the ship. They do a head count and they
connected.
discount, and they've brought Hannibal Lecter back on the cruise ship.
Nobody would have to know about it. It's just our protagonist suspects it, right? And it's you right or not. That doesn't make any sense what you
Well,
said.
this is us. Okay, so we're reading or over on our Patreon, our thriller corner, and two
Yeah.
authors. We got to work this out if we're going to do this. Two author sort of murder mystery slash we write a, I don't know,
We email back and
pamphlet.
forth, yeah.
Yeah, we would email. I my twist would be a little bit more non-believable. I think you would have to steer us back on course, and I would just veer
Yeah.
off, and you would have to drive us back.
I have to deal with like whatever you just said about the serial killer rowboating ashore on the
Yeah, bro. He's yeah, I don't know. Do you want to get your our guest this
Yeah,
week?
let me go grab him. I thought it interesting. It's also once again in a footnote, but at the beginning he's talking about how he looked into kind of the ownership of most cruise ships, and they wound up being Greek or Scandinavian. He says pretty much the people who have mastered the sea travel, like from way back, meaning, the ancient
Yeah.
Greeks and the Vikings. I thought that was kind of interesting. Like, oh yeah, that is true. Scandinavians and Greeks own cruise ships. That's it. That's it. Let me go get our guests.
I'll fill the dead air.
Fill the dead air. Let me leave you with this. He talks about how he's noticing people outdoors on the cruise ships and how they no longer wear their sunglasses. You know, people, when they're not wearing sunglasses, they'd flip them up on their forehead. That used to be the style when Foster Wallace was growing up, but he notices they no longer do that. What, Peter, do people do now? Is
They
it the shirt on?
just wear them, right?
Well, when they're not wearing them, do they put them in the neck of their shirt?
Oh yeah, they do. Okay.
That
I don't know if
was
that's that interesting, but
Oh.
that All right, we have a special guest. Matt's cooler brother is joining us. Matt is the, if you don't know this already, he's the third in the coolness of his brothers.
I'm the oldest, though.
That doesn't matter. See, it's a reverse thing. Oldest is less cool, right?
Yeah.
And we've brought your brother on to discuss general ideas about books, or he's got
Got a
theories.
couple. Yeah. This is my brother Jeffrey.
Hello.
Yeah. He is the most erudite of us, I guess. I don't know how you describe it. He doesn't take a lot of flattery either. So
Can
we'll
I
move
ask a
along.
quick question? Has he had six
Okay.
cups of coffee today?
Like measuring cups coffee or like mugs?
Mugs.
No, I've only had three.
Okay.
Yeah.
Family
Drinks
of coffee
coffee.
drinkers. Because Matt just said earlier he had six cups of coffee today.
I opened with how weird I feel because I had six cups of coffee before the movie and then jelly beans and Diet Coke.
Just
Yeah.
a
I was kind of
mess.
riding a weird wave of
Just a mess.
yeah. How was Indiana Jones 5?
Better than Crystal Skull. Oh. It was, as far as Indiana Jones movies go, not the worst.
Yeah. So.
Matt was saying how...
All right. You got 3 hours.
Matt was saying they're all weird in some way. It's a good point. It's a good point.
I was defending the aliens in Crystal Skull. Say what you will about Crystal Skull.
Magic rocks in Temple of Doom, or, you know, what was the other one? The Ark of the Covenant and melting faces and floating spirits. It's all weird.
Yeah, flying saucers aren't out of keeping with the canon of those stories. Anyway, consensus, Indiana Jones 5. If you have 3 hours to kill, go see it, but it's not going to change your life or anything.
I don't think I'm going to see it, I'm going to be honest with you.
All right, you don't need to.
Okay, good.
All right, so I wanted to ask, Jeff is a big Wendell Berry fan, right? Is that fair to say?
It's fair.
Yeah. So we're about to start reading Jaber Crow. What should we look for as we read it? Are there any sort of themes or anything we should keep an eye out for that would enhance our enjoyment?
Have you read Wendell Berry at all?
No.
No. Well, he's an agrarian philosopher, right? So he's all about rural American, you know, farm culture and how technological progress has destroyed it or is destroying it, and you should care. So all his poetry, his essays and nonfiction and his fiction stuff is all pointing in that direction. So I think Jaber is the only one of the novels that focuses on a non-farmer or someone that's not in a farming family. He's a city boy, as far as, you know, a small Kentucky town has city boys, but he can sort of watch the progress of this town over time. And so you get it from a non-farmer perspective, this sort of decline of American rural life because of technological progress.
I like that. I'm interested in, like, the percentage of farmers in the United States has, like, declined since forever. And I feel like this is going to be sort of not, you know, directly discussing that, but sort of hinting at that nature. Maybe.
It's one in a series, right? How far back? It's a series of people from the town of Port William?
Yes. Yeah. Port William, Kentucky. And it's the, he's just watching characters over time. The earliest memories, I think the earliest stories go back toward the Civil War. Okay. And then up through, you know, I guess the Andy Catlett stories are probably the most modern. But you're watching the life of the town and the town's people and the people surrounding the town over time.
This feels like right up my alley, Matt.
I think you're gonna like it. I'm on chapter 4.
Okay.
And it's basically from the barber. It's a small town barber kind of giving his life story, and it's kind of wrapped around, yeah, the larger series that Jeff was talking about.
There's an author called David Rhodes, I want to say, and he's written some, he just passed away last year, but he kind of wrote similarly about, like, I think he was writing about Wisconsin, but like sort of small town, farming towns, and like most of his books maybe don't have all the same characters, but they like talk about them in a way. It's sort of, I don't know, real life. Those are fantastic books, like Jewelweed. I'm hoping that I see like the similarities between that kind of like writing style. It's my hope, because it sounds like I'm gonna like this book a lot. So
I think you will. He's a good writer. His essays are fantastic. I've read some of his essays. I'm looking forward to reading this.
This does not have anything to do with Jaber Crow, but I saw this news story about this farming technique that they are introducing, where it's a big, looks like a combine, and it's lasers that are destroying the weeds. Have you seen this?
I have not.
And they're saying like the pharmaceutical companies or whatever, or like the, you know, pesticide companies are gonna like try to squash this, because it's just, it looks like lights are just flashing and they're actually burning up. Look it up. It's very expensive, but
I mean, better than pouring glyphosate on everything.
I don't know. I just saw it on the internet and I was like, oh, that seems interesting. And then people are like, this isn't going to work. Pesticide companies are going to squash this.
Wow.
So, that's depressing.
Or is that more technology that's kind of ruined the agrarian lifestyle?
Yeah, which would be better? lasers and pesticides.
As Wendell Berry says, I don't remember where, but science and technology can neatly solve one problem by cutting it in two and having two problems. So I don't know. The laser sounds cool. It sounds better than chemical, but
it looks cool. Say that. It looks cool. I don't know how it works. I don't know how it like differentiates between like a weed and the crop. That I have no idea how that works. Because it's just, I don't know. It's weird.
People run around with plant identification apps on their phone these days. So I'm sure that a cell phone, the difference between corn and pigweed.
Okay. I thought I'd give you that tidbit. That's all I got.
I like it. All right, do you want to get this off your chest, Jeff? What's the difference between a buffalo and a bison? And are there buffalo in America?
Oh, man. Are we speaking the lingua franca? Or are we like, in American vernacular, there's no difference. In scientific vernacular, yeah, buffalo belong in Africa, Cape Buffalo. Water buffalo, Mediterranean region, and Southeast Asia. Bison exist in North America, and they are more closely related to cattle than they are to buffalo.
There you go.
There are no buffalo in America.
I'd look at you. Your brother off backpack, because I would have been like, I've heard there are no pure, maybe there's only like two or three, bison herds that are like not mixed with cattle. Is that correct?
Yes, and I would wager that some of those that are claiming that they're pure
are not. Pure
bison are probably not.
Okay.
There was too much mixing in the colonial period, and you can get, well, this gets complicated. You can test mitochondrial DNA and find that your herd is free, but few people test nuclear DNA, and when they do, they usually find cattle genes.
So, your brother is so much smarter than you, Matt.
I know, right? I'm not. That's not me being humble. It's like, yeah.
And it's funny. The listener can't tell. Matt, has seemingly, from my viewpoint, shrunk down in the screen. He looks like he's like sitting in a little boy's chair, and his brother is sitting much taller. That's the conversation has drastically, like, gotten smarter to the point, you know. Before this, we were talking about murder mystery and how we were getting serial killers onto cruise ships. And now we're talking about the nuclear level of bison in America. And it's going to be jarring for the listener. You know.
Hopefully they learned something.
I think they did.
I'm going to write a letter to Josh Allen. Tell him that his team mascot is just all wrong.
Well, I mean, anyway.
Hey, I want to get this too. Your theory on the once and future king, because he's read the whole once and future king. Peter, how far are you?
Okay. This is my issue. We've been supposedly reading this book for a year. I brought it on a camping trip, and then I just haven't picked it up for like 9 months. I'm happy to report, in the last week, I've read almost 100 pages of the book. It's fantastic. I love it. I will get this done in a month, okay? I'm so sorry to the listener, Matt. You cannot no longer talk about that C.S. Lewis book because I'm actively reading the book.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. But the whole book or just Sword in the Stone?
I'm going to finish the whole book in the next month.
Okay, good. Yeah, we're going to break it up. We're going to do 3 or 4 episodes on the whole thing. But Jeff has a... Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, Jeff, I want to hear your theory about...
It was a good... It's not the whole thing, but your little kind of... theory on the once and future king.
Yeah.
Does it work?
Sure. Well, I'll also say I haven't picked it up in 9 months either, because I finished it 9 months ago. so I don't remember all the details here.
I'm going to slouch down in my chair like Matt, because
sorry, I'm holding the...
I just have a tall chair.
Yeah.
No, it's fitting. It's representative of your thoughts here.
When you say you're recording in your attic, I picture my attic with like blown insulation and cobwebs. That looks pretty nice.
Nice attic.
So I read Once and Future King as sort of an archetype or a pattern of the rise and fall of civilizations and governmental regimes. You know, the first book, Wart is he sort of visits all the different animals and learns how their different societal systems work. And he settles on this idea of justice ruling in the second book and sort of takes over, what's his kingdom called? England or whatever.
Britannia.
Sets up his kingdom. And then book three, things start to fall apart for several reasons. And then the fourth one is the decline of the kingdom and he has to give it up in the end, right?
I don't think I would have, yeah. When he's meeting the animals, I'm just like, oh, that's kind of fun.
Yeah.
I'm like, I wonder what animals I would meet.
Well, they each have a different societal sort of structure and the way they work things out. And he learns those different patterns and what their benefits and flaws are before he sets up his own kingdom in book two.
Yeah. Okay. It's like a guy shooting for the ideal form of government with his like wise old wizard mentor. And yeah.
So you're saying there's more to it than just, how about that?
Yeah. And you'll get, I think it kind of imitates or is what it's a human life cycle. The first, The Sword in the Stone is delightful. It's a children's book. It's from a child's point of view. And it goes through, by the end, you realize
it's more serious.
It gets way more serious. So Jeff started reading it to his kids and they love Sword in the Stone. And you had to trail off and stop because it got inappropriate for him about when.
We were tempted to stop in book two, but I think we actually gave up in some part of book three.
Okay.
Yeah, it gets kind of dark and serious, and there's a love, the whole Lancelot Guinevere infidelity stuff. It's like, oh. Wow.
Don't they make The Sword in the Stone is a Disney movie? Like, correct?
You should watch that before you do the episode. It's not the same thing. Okay. It's kind of a fun Disney movie, but it's stripped down. Yeah.
Because it kind of reminds me of The Hobbit in a way.
It's fun. It should be, I think it should be up there with Tolkien and Lewis as far as those kind of British fantasy novels.
It's funny, really too. Like, it's
hilarious.
Yeah. That's what I was most surprised by, like, just humor and, like, entertainment wise. It's not
so funny. King Eleanor is like Lord Emsworth. Like, it's hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point. Yeah. It's. Anyway. Sounds like the laughs don't stay the whole time. We get a little serious.
Yeah, there's a lot to it.
Okay.
So, yeah.
And I'm reading the book, okay?
Oh, it's good. It's good. We can do a new seasonal once we finish that.
I will say I'm going camping here shortly in the next month. So I don't know if the camping was the reason why I stopped reading the book, because I did take it and then I stopped reading the book. No, I'm going to finish the book. That's my, it's July 7th. By August 7th, I will have the book finished, Matt.
All right.
Four books.
Okay. Well, we'll do Sword and Stone. We'll kind of.
There's a 50% chance that won't happen though. I'm going to completely.
Yeah, it's all right. I think if Jeff's agreed, I think he can help us break down some of the.
Oh yeah. This.
In book three or four.
I'm a little afraid to voice my like thoughts on the book because these seem like real literary thoughts. And I'm just like, you know what? I liked it when he was with the fish or whatever.
Yeah, he turned the fish.
I thought that was delightful. And you're like, well, that's not what that was about, Peter.
It's about power. Anyway, we'll get into it.
Right. Jaber Crow and the Once and Future King. Coming up on the podcast. Yeah. We're kind of catching up on our TBR a little bit. We haven't picked a July book, so, but we're making progress.
I agree.
Matt, any final thoughts from Kansas? Have you run into Ben Lerner? Is Topeka as lovely as you remember? Is it hot in Kansas? What's the temperature like there?
It's
summer.
Really nice for July in Kansas. It was hot until 4th of July, and then rain. It's been cool.
It's in Colorado. It's been very rainy and thunderstorms, and 4th of July was almost rained out for a lot of people because the severity of the storms. But yeah, it's been kind of cool here too. So yeah. I don't know, man.
Been good. It's been a good trip to Pete because you know it's nice. It's a nice place. I'm not bitter about my hometown anymore.
You're not bitter about it?
Yeah.
You were good. You were bitter once?
Eh, whatever.
just like, oh, I'm anxious to leave because I grew up here. But you know what? It's nice.
Can I say a pet peeve of mine that I've had for a while to end this episode?
Yeah.
But people come to where we live and they always ask, oh yeah, where? And I always tell them, yeah, I grew up here. And they're always amazed that someone could be living in the place that they were born in. Yeah. Still. And they look at me like I'm an alien. And I just want to be like, it's not that weird.
Yeah, it really isn't.
Yeah, and I want to be like, you moved here.
Yeah.
So why, like, and because they always think like, have you ever been to a city? I'm like, yes, I have. It's very annoying. It just happened to me like a week ago at a work function for my wife. They're like, where are you from? I was like, oh, I was born here. And they're like, get out of here. You were born here? I'm like, yes. Anyway, that's a pet peeve of mine. People can live in the cities and towns that they were born in. It's fine.
Yeah. I mean, Jeff does.
More or less.
Sort of. He lives in a different town. That he lives in Kansas.
Do you agree with me, Jeff? It's an annoying thing to say to a person. Like, oh, I can't believe you're from state here.
It sounds strange to me. Yeah. I've never had that happen to me.
I'd
get annoyed. I'd be confused.
Okay.
Yeah. We live in the front range of Colorado is kind of, there's a lot of people from a lot of different places move out there. Mm-hmm. That might have something to do with
it. It's kind of a desirable place to move to, but for that to be the case, people are like, oh, I can't believe I've never met someone who's actually born here. It's like, well.
I don't know that would happen here. I think a lot of people born here or are from Kansas kind of stay. I bet that's true in a lot of places too. But I think the Colorado thing might be a little different because a lot of people move there. It's like New York, right? Yeah. A lot of people move there.
It might be a Midwest thing too. I think a lot of people from the Midwest stay in the Midwest. I know Kansas is not technically is Kansas the Midwest? I don't
know. Yeah, it's almost the epitome. It's almost exactly in the middle.
Well, is that Midwest? I think of like Ohio.
Yeah, it's the whole big. It always bugs me when people say like Michigan and Minnesota are the Midwest because I always think, oh, that's north, in the middle, but it's as far north as you can go.
I think we need to add some geographical locations. We are podcasting in 2024 as we add mid-north to the Midwest. Anyway, this is going to be a long episode. We're almost an hour and a half.
Hope it's worth your while.
Thank you, Jeff. I got an incomplete, Jeff. I want to point this out. Quickly, have you read David Foster Wallace?
I have only read Consider the Lobster.
Okay.
I found Matt's book here earlier this week and I was reading it surreptitiously when he was out of the room.
Did you like it? Should I leave it with you?
Yeah, if you're done with it, I'll read it.
I got in trouble because I didn't read the footnotes on the essay we were talking about today. And I didn't read
read footnotes.
No.
All right. I'll leave it with you because back to the footnotes.
All right, incomplete. I got an incomplete for this episode. It's been fun, Jeff. Thank you for joining us. I think you made us both feel like we're not that smart, and I think that's always good to remember, man. Be humbled. Always improve. It's key. Matt, drive safe. Get back to Colorado safe. Jeff, good to see you. I don't know what we're talking about next week. Any ideas, Matt? Probably a book.
Elmore Leonard or something else like that.
You can do Elmore Leonard and maybe pick a July book.
It's on the hot, sweaty summer July book.
I like it.
Yeah.
I like it.
I've literally gained 10 pounds in 2 days. So, it's a good vacation.
And on that note, we will talk to you next week.